This is the Liminalist, the podcast between, and this is Jason Halsey now talking to Orange. The quality of the recording is below my usual standard. That's because I really wanted to stay in the hammock for this conversation, and so I chose to forego good microphone and whatnot. So I hope you'll bear with it. I thought that this was worth making into a podcast despite that technical setback. This is my conversation with Aaron.
So, you emailed me about, with specific focus on lucid view, which is not that common. I mean, it's been quite a while since then. Occasionally I still get people, and that book probably has reached more people than anything else I've written, so.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned, well, the influence the book had, and that you might want to talk about a little bit about that and about me as a person, and then you mentioned your own struggles in the Matrix. Did you read Matrix Warrior then?
No, I haven't read anything besides The Lucid View, and I just started recently reading your blog, so, like, nothing else.
Okay. Right, so when did you read Lucid View?
I read it, when did I read it? Maybe a year ago, and then I started reading it, just flipping through it again a few weeks ago.
Was it the revised edition?
Let me see. Hold on one second. It is, which one is this one? I have it right here. Copyright 2004.
Yeah, no, that's the old edition.
That's the old, okay.
Yeah, I'm very embarrassed by that edition. It's painful to me to think that somebody is still reading that, but I'm powerless.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. So you're embarrassed by that. The second one had a lot more edits and additions.
It didn't have many additions. It had edits. It was just cleaned out. I mean, the first three chapters of Lucid View are just horrendous in terms of writing and syntax and grammar and all the rest of it. I was appalled to discover that. I couldn't. There was no way for me to update Lucid View to actually represent my current perspective. I would just end up gutting it probably or writing a different book. But I at least wanted to, you know, make it. In terms of style and whatnot to get it up to speed. Cause I was just very sloppy back in those days. I had no awareness of it. Of course, one doesn't when one is being sloppy. But anyway, I don't want to detract from your experience. It's what we were here to talk about. So, how was the book? Like, what exactly was it about the book that you found so, impactful?
Sure. Yes, I'd love to share that with you. You could probably have like a 30-hour conversation to answer that one question, but I've always, since I had conscious thought, I've always thought differently than everybody else, and my parents did think I had Asperger's, and I had, so many of the things you said were just so validating, just kind of like what I said in the email, to have another human being, to know that there's another human being who thinks that there might be a connection between, say, this I saw on her blog, say, between OCD and Asperger's and and psychic ability is so gratifying. And your book, the thing that like really excited me was the inclusion of UFOs and aliens and conspiracy theory and all the biblical stuff. But I think the thing I love the most is perhaps the idea of being in the unknown, being in the liminal space. To not know is what you advocate, and I really, really love that because I believe in not knowing. That's what I do for professionally. I use that as I'm a psychotherapist. I use that as a therapist, and we live in a culture that obviously doesn't like that idea. So those are some big highlights.
Right. Oh, that's very interesting. About the therapist bit particularly. Not knowing. A professional not knower. So, how long have you been practicing psychotherapy?
I've been doing psychotherapy for 7 years.
Uh-huh. What kind is that?
Say that again?
What kind of therapy is it?
I practice somatic psychotherapy, which is a... Do you know what that is?
I know what somatic means, but I haven't heard about this particular...
Yes. It's in the holistic realm, and it is all about body. Body awareness, and some somatic therapists use therapeutic touch as well. And just really supporting people out of their left brain and into their sensational awareness, their interoceptive internal experience as part of the work.
Yeah, wow. And how did you come across that, and what's how long has this been around, and how did it begin?
Sure. So I was very disembodied, very disconnected from my body for the majority of my life, and knew it somehow. And I was, I had depression, anxiety, OCD, and Asperger's, and was suicidal at 18. And instead of killing myself, I decided to try to heal myself. And so just went on a, you know, the classical journey that a lot of folks do, and tried a little of everything and bumped into body-based therapies and energy healing and all these kinds of things, and got very attracted to this lineage. And it was founded by Wilhelm Reich, one of he attempted to be one of Freud's students. He was a contemporary of Jung. Have you ever heard of Wilhelm Reich?
Of course, yeah. Everybody knows Wilhelm Reich, at least in the this sort of alternate perceptions field. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's one of my heroes, and so my field is it's his field. He is the grandfather of somatic psychotherapy.
No, I hadn't heard about it. Even though, I mean, I've read a fair bit. I've read some of Reich and a fair bit about him, but I haven't come across that. I mean, body armor, the concept of body armor, of course, I'm familiar.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm. So, and how long have you been, 7 years, you said, and
yes,
how old are you now?
And say this again?
How old are you now?
I'm 37.
Well, this person I just spoke to, Martin, he was 37 too. Just astrologically, it's quite significant age, so. Interesting. Anyway, two in a row.
Two 37-year-olds in a row, huh?
Yeah, actually, yes. There's one. There was a guy in between who's Nick, who's 27,
uh-huh. Wow.
I think. So you've been doing it since you were 30.
Yes.
and
yes.
No, it's certainly. I mean, I'm not entirely sure about Reich. I mean, we could talk about Reich and all that.
Sure.
It might be a digression because it just might. But the premise of what you're talking about is very close to my own heart, I guess.
Uh-huh.
To use visceral imagery there. I mean, it's just the sense I have, as you probably picked up. We wouldn't have picked it up from this view, though, because that was definitely in my disembodied period. So it's interesting, to use that very easy word, that
uh-huh.
you were drawn to me by something that I wrote that I would now see as very disembodied and really kind of exactly at odds with, because you know it was
sure.
part of the journey that got me to where I am
sure.
today, but
sure.
still, I mean, one of the things that I've discovered about writing that I didn't know when I was writing Lucid View, I mean, didn't even occur to me, is that it, like anything, perhaps, it can be a means to embodiment or it can be a means to stay disembodied, and that
sure.
the proof is in the pudding. And so I would say, I just did say that Lucid View is kind of a disembodied piece of writing as compared to more recent stuff that I've done,
sure.
Prisoner of Infinity and Seen and Not Seen and Occult Yorkshire, which have become more and more about, I think what you're talking about is this movement from the left brain or the rational, intellectual, perceptual mode to a more bodily one. And so I would say, like as a writer, like trying to unlock the secrets that are trapped in my body through writing and then to write what I discover, you know, to try and transcribe what my body is telling me.
Yes. Yes, that's, wow. That description sounds beautiful, yes, to me. Yeah, so yes, it is ironic that I was attracted to this book because, I mean, it makes sense to me because I still have such an attraction to anything left-brain, and it's one of the reasons I'm in this field is because my, you know, like so many people, my comfort zone is disembodied. It really validated so much of the stuff that so many of the balls that bounce around my left brain, you know. So
I guess when you talk about practicing unknowing or not knowing and how you appreciated that, because it's true, it was there in Lucid View, and that's become
sure.
much, much more central with liminality and stuff. But I guess it's another way of understanding a somatic relationship with existence, as in it's the intellect that can compartmentalize and decide what's true and what's false, and create a system of knowledge by which we convince ourselves that we can know stuff. But at a bodily level, there's not that the body can't know things. I think it's kind of ironic and paradoxical because I think the body is the only thing that can actually know anything. But I mean,
sure.
for the mind to start allowing for the communication from the body to take over its own rational
yes.
processes, that would be a state of not knowing to the intellect. Is that right?
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I've been experiencing this, of course, my whole life, as you would probably recognize and agree as a therapist, it's always going on, but I mean, I've become more cognizant of it. I guess progressively over the years, so, but it always seems like a relatively new thing, at least now it does. So, participating in this group with Dave O'Shaughnessy, who I don't talk about much on the podcast because I just don't think it's really helpful, but what's going on there is and it does, it does happen on this podcast too. I mean, it's one of the reasons I do this podcast, talking to strangers and not knowing what we're going to talk about. But this experience of knowing that I want to express and communicate and share and connect and participate in life, but not having a prior knowledge of what it is that I'm here to express.
Yes.
I mean, that's a, it's a strange thing, isn't it? I mean, it's an existential dilemma for human beings.
Yes.
I mean, we could get intellectual about it and say how, well, all that, you know, animals don't have this problem because they have their instincts and we're different in that way. But whatever the case, I mean, it seems to me it's a fundamental experience of human beings unless we manage to avoid it. Is that who am I don't know, you know, experience.
Right.
What am I here for? I don't know. Why am I doing this, whatever it is, in any given moment? I don't know. Like this recurring answer of I don't know.
Right. Yes. Yeah, and so you enter into conversations on your podcast not knowing, I haven't listened to your podcast, and I was vaguely aware that you had podcasts, but now I'm very aware. So you enter into your podcasts not knowing where the thing is going to go, and intentionally so.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make it sound more unusual than it is. I mean, two people have conversations all the time, and that's what a podcast is. And you know, I don't entirely eschew the structure, as in if I'm inviting somebody to talk or if I'm accepting somebody's request to talk, as in your case. There's some foundation. Like, I know you read those reviews, so we got that. I didn't ask for more. I mean, I could have found out that you were a somatic therapist and researched that and prepared questions. You know, it can go all the way to one extreme.
Sure.
And I wouldn't sound quite at the other extreme of just complete lack of structure, but I get as close to it as I can without, I mean, it's important for the other person to feel comfortable. Even if I'm, you know, to the extent that I'm willing not to be comfortable. The thing is I'm very comfortable talking. I mean, I'm a talker. I was since a kid. To a fault, I would say. Like, it's part of my constructed identity to use articulation and eloquence as a defense or as a shield. So then it's important for me to let go of that. But even as I'm letting go of it, I'm not going to lose the ability, like, it's something that's so ingrained in me, the ability to to speak on my feet, so to speak. Yeah.
Sure. It's on one hand, it's a protective mechanism for you. On the other hand, it's also the way you put words to your body's real-time experience.
Yeah.
So it's both so it's like kind of both protection and revelation.
Yeah, and so there's something there about letting words become the carriers of a deeper information than we normally recognize they are carriers of, and recognizing that, like, that's the thing that that can happen with a conversation, and it doesn't generally happen with conversations, and certainly not podcasts, where there's a pressure to speak and there's an awareness that it's being recorded and you know, it's going to be listened to, and all of those factors that make us even more self-conscious than we normally are. And the distance, of course, long distance. We can't just relax.
Sure.
You know, if you were in the garden, we could stop talking at any time and just look around, and we'd still be together. But if we stop talking now, we'd feel like we'd lose contact.
Yes, there isn't. If we were in the same space, we would have the ability to have those natural pregnant pauses. So let me ask you, is that your intention? And I'm okay with that. Is that your intention to record this conversation for the sake of a podcast?
Didn't we agree on that?
I didn't know that, but now I do.
Okay, well, it's always open, as in, even if it's a formal interview, I always tell people, look, I can't guarantee this will be a podcast, and you can say no at the end of it too.
Sure.
I think that's always the context that I have.
I see.
Yeah, so, but for some reason, I thought I had emailed you and said, what a coincidence, because I just put out an invitation to people to podcast, wasn't that you?
Yes. Well, you said, what a coincidence, but because I just put out an invitation, but I don't think you said to podcast.
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't get the context at the time, but now I'm getting the context.
Yeah. Little by little. Funny, cause I was talking about recording the beginning as well, so you also know,
yes,
I was recording. But this is great, because this is it's like we're actually experiencing and enacting the thing that I was talking about, the lack of structure, and like, is this a podcast or is it a conversation?
And
is there a difference, and if so, why?
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny, the reason why I didn't hit me as too odd, because I had a teacher in my life named Reb Zalman. Have you ever heard of Reb Zalman?
No.
He was a Jewish kind of New Age thought leader, and I was one of his inner circle students, and he recorded all of our conversations because, you know, he was old and he died 2 years ago, and he wanted to have the majority of what he shared with others recorded for others to listen to. Any wisdom that came out, he wanted to have it recorded. So I made an assumption that was your intention. So if this conversation feels like it mutually wants, if it mutually feels like it wants to be podcasted, I'm totally fine with that. But now, yes, we are embodying the middle path between structure and non-structure.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes. I'm kind of tickled by our respective, you thought that I knew and I didn't know, and so this is it's almost exciting to me somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, and that's part of what I was saying about not preparing and whatnot. I don't know how much people know about me if they reach out to me, of course, and I do. I wouldn't say I get it a lot. Like you said in your email, I must get people asking to talk to me all the time. Well, I know that's not true. But I do get fairly regular emails, a few a week, a couple of weeks or something.
Sure.
People who've read this or read that, and they generally testify quite a lot. Like they, they want to share quite a bit about themselves, and those are the kind of emails I get. So there is which is very fitting because, you know, I'm somebody for whom personal connections are kind of, well, they're not everything, but they're essential. I barely even listen to music now unless it's somebody I know or I've had some personal connection with. I still watch TV shows. But anyway, it's very important to me, like, to have that personal connection. And so it's fitting that people, obviously, they get that sense. You know, I mean, the reason people like certain writers or artists or public figures or what have you is that they feel like they know them. And mostly that's an illusion, of course. But in my case, it's less of an illusion because, although again, you wouldn't know this because of all you read is Lucid View, but what I do have done more recently is very, very personal, and very, very intimate, really. And so the podcast is a continuation of that, just bringing it into, like, why I do what I do, besides unlocking the secrets of my body, which is the main thing, but why make it public? Well, because I want to, I mean, because that's actually a safer space for me to do it in. It's like I've turned the whole world into my analysis couch. And why that is, well, because I think it has to do with, I always felt disconnected as a child to my surroundings. Like I didn't, my family wasn't there. They were drunk or they were bullying or they were this or that. And so I had a very formative, as you probably did based on what you said already, experience of being alienated, disconnected and isolated. So for me to communicate publicly is essentially a way to connect to others. So then why not actually literalize that?
Yes, it's fascinating because I'm hearing you use this like public venue to get the connection that you didn't have as a child, and it's one of the questions I sit with myself deeply. Is that I felt profoundly disconnected from the environment I lived in. I had such different thinking that my thoughts weren't inquired about or welcomed. And now as an adult, I have such divergent views and pretty extreme views. Just to name a few before I name a few, just to say, like, I am scared to have authentic conversation in a public venue, lest a witch hunt take place. And so but then I'm constantly feeling lonely. And so I am sitting with very, very deeply the question of to what degree do I come out of the closet and put myself out there? Because even the people who think they know me don't know me. And so, I am, there's this, my heart is just like so excited to hear that that's what you're doing, and it's inspiring. And I personally would be scared to do that, lest I would be marginalized on some level.
Ostracized, scapegoated. Yes,
especially because I have two children, and some of my, you know, I and it raises, it ups the ante pretty intensely. Even as a therapist, I have pretty radical views that most therapists would want my license. You know, I would not. I would be unlicensed if people knew some of my beliefs, and so, which I'd be glad to share, but just on a general level, I'm appreciating that you do it, and I'm wanting to do that, but I'm scared.
Well, there's quite a few people, obviously, who feel that way, that who specifically who I end up podcasting. Like, one of the things I ask people, do a podcast with me, if it turns into a podcast, is I want a picture of them, and that's okay if they don't want to use their real name. I totally understand that, and it's not, I don't see it as that important if they're, you know, they're not public figures anyway, but I do want a picture of them, because I want, well, there's various reasons, but one of them, the main one perhaps, is I want to encourage them, leaving a little bit of pressure there, to let go of those fears about being seen and being exposed in their strangeness or their taboo-ness or whatever else it is. And that that's, I mean, along with the thing I was saying about, liminalism relating to being in unknowing and letting the body express and stuff, is the, I guess it's a different way of looking at the same thing, but that if there are things that we're afraid to say, and there are, of course, for all of us, I think it's becoming more intense now, intensifying the pressure not to say certain things. Then, and if we don't confront that and say them anyway, then over time that becomes internalized, and we'll cease thinking about the things that we're afraid to express. And so for me, it's really like expressing freely is, it's ironic because, you know, free speech is constitutional and all that. It's actually in the kind of, you know, the institutionalized value set of the importance of free speech, even as it's being eroded. And I certainly don't, I mean, generally speaking, I don't think the institutions have a sense of what really has value in our lives by any means, but there is a coincidental overlap there in terms of this institutionalized value of freedom of speech, and what I'm so concerned with, that I value so much in my own work is being an example. And that's more of a side effect than the goal, but I recognize it, of a willingness to speak despite the fear of being condemned for doing so. Like, I do it compulsively. I just go off to say good cow.
Bless your heart. Yes. I'm excited to hear you say those things. And there's this, as you're talking, there's this arising in my center of my chest that's just like wanting to just like almost like throw up all of my truth, just like rapid fire into this conversation, which I'd be glad to, but I just want to acknowledge that it's, you're definitely exciting me as you speak.
Well, it isn't it largely illusory, this fear, because there are fears that are rational. I'm not a new age preacher who says that, you know, we shouldn't fear anything, and there's plenty of fears that are rational and practical and useful, but the fear of being exposed for having thoughts or values that are, you know, socially unacceptable. Well, of course, there is a real aspect to that. We can actually be scapegoated. But at what point does the real fear become an illusory fear, and vice versa?
Right.
I think it's really important.
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of overlap there, and some of it's totally imagined and some of it's real. And
like, yes. like you were saying about the you could lose your license for believing certain things. It was an interesting time because just right before we started speaking, I was researching various psychotherapists and psychiatrists who belong to a spiritual group in Edmonton that I'm researching. You might have seen it in the blog, John DeRuta.
Oh, yeah, I read that, yeah.
Right. Parts of it, yeah. So, and I believe that this group is participating in abuses and, you know, brainwashing and causing harm to people's cognitive faculties and maybe worse. And I found out recently there's a whole bunch of psychotherapists on, you know, in the group, and that they counsel people in the group when they have doubts about John. So, so there's, you know, certain people in the group are saying, I don't really think that what John is doing is right, and I'm really conflicted. He's having sex with his followers, and then these therapists, or you know, one of them, whichever, whoever takes on that person, will tell them that the issue is with them, that what John is doing is right and good, and that I will help you look at your own issues around this, but the bottom line is that John is good, and that you have issues around it that you need to resolve in order to see the truth that John is good, right? So basically, I know, I mean, that has got to be therapeutic malpractice at some level.
Yes. Yeah? Yes. That would definitely be therapeutic malpractice, yes, by all standards, yes.
I would say so, but it would be hard to, you know, prove it if the client didn't complain or object, I think.
Right.
But anyway, I mean, we don't have to, that was just some little background, sort of coincidental timing, bringing it back to yourself. Is it true that you could lose your license for believing certain things?
I mean, if I were to profess the things I think publicly, I would lose my license.
Well, what's an example?
Example is I am against mandatory reporting to CPS, Child Protective Services. Right. You know, therapists have an obligation to breach confidentiality when there's a report of sexual or physical abuse to children or elders. And I believe that it should be up to the therapist whether to make that decision, because I think I have witnessed that it is typically more harm than good occurs when those reports are made. CPS, depending on the jurisdiction, can be a bull in a china shop and do more harm than good. So it's a law. It's a prerequisite to my license. It's a law. And that would be an example where if I were to go public, I would have to lose my, I would have to, and so what I do is I engage a lot of therapists in like robust conversations and try to finding loopholes around the law for specific reasons. But, that would be an example.
Right. So, yeah, that is very specific. That's like if you're on the jury and you're deciding someone's guilty or not guilty and they're going to get the death penalty, and you say, look, I don't believe in the death penalty, so I'm always going to vote non-guilty, then you get kicked off the jury. It's that,
exactly.
That kind of setup. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So that's, I mean, that's a very interesting package in itself. I don't know if you picked up, you know, how much of my focus is on child sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Organized, however, not primarily domestic, but of course that goes on too. So yeah, and then the question also is, you know, are the child protection agencies part of networks that are abusing children, right?
Right.
That's a very real question.
I think I was aware, I haven't seen it directly, but I think through other writers, like the way I got to you is through Jason Kristoff. Do you know who he is?
No, don't.
That's how I found you. He quoted you. He is a big anti-vax guy, and through Jason Kristoff, I became aware of a lot of the organized sex abuse rings, and when I say I'm against CPS, it's not because I've witnessed CPS Bringing kids from foster care, or whatever, into organized sex rings, but I have seen them do some pretty emotionally abusive things to children, and medically inappropriate things to children. And but the sexual abuse rings is kind of something I haven't personally witnessed. I've heard about through Jason Christoph, and now I'm hearing that you also have researched a little bit of that.
More than a little bit. It's a pretty pretty central now. To,
wow.
Like it doesn't. There's hardly a podcast goes by where it doesn't come up. Because of, for me, it's the context of all the disorders and all the neuroses and all the dysfunctioning and the suicidal ideation, right, and addiction, and you name it. I mean, it's to me, it's all sorts of trauma, psychological trauma, and a large part of that is can be laid at the feet of these organized programs of abuse.
It's the place to be. In your research, have you, are government organization, are you saying, like, I know, like, I've heard it through Jason Christoph that it's like these rich folks who organize these kinds of rituals and stuff. Would you suggest also, like, CPS in particular or foster care systems are involved in those?
Most of my research was in the UK because that's where I grew up. So I had I had my own family history to refer to, which is obviously very useful in keeping it more grounded and more experiential. So in the UK, there's a wealth of very unpleasant information about how childcare was a front. You know, child homes were fronts for these rings, and the children were being farmed out and what have you. Adoption isn't so common in the UK, although I guess it's becoming more so, but foster homes and all that is something I associate more with the US, and no, I haven't done research there, but well, the extent of these programs, as far as I've, you know, as far as my research has led me to believe, the extent of them is so vast, and we're talking historic as well, I mean, going back to ancient Greece, kind of historic. So it's more than just programs, it's methodologies, it's like a methodology, trauma genesis, sort of shaping and creating culture through psychic trauma and abuse and so on. The I mean, it's kind of, at a certain point it gets flipped over and I start to see, not necessarily you or anyone else, that it's not that these organizations have been infiltrated or compromised or corrupted by individuals pursuing these dark agendas. It's that the organizations and the institutions themselves have arisen out of the programs of abuse. So they were actually generated by these by these practices, you know, by traumatized individuals. And so, you know, there's no clear dividing line, as you would know, working with clients individually between unconscious, you know, drives and programs that are leading people into forms of action and conscious agendas.
Right.
They blur into each other. So that,
sure,
that's true historically and socially. And so then we're talking about something like the CPS, the likelihood that something like that that is a primary force in moving children around wouldn't be serving these larger cultural agendas if they exist. And I'm not going to tell you they are, because it's up to you to look at the research I've done and decide. But if they do exist, the chances that the CPS wouldn't be part of them are kind of zero. Really.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I definitely take the view, like, so again, like, I'm not so familiar with institutional sexual abuse, but I do take, like, more of a macro view, which is probably in sync with this, which is that, so, and I don't understand a lot about what I'm about to say, but, like, I just intuitively have a feeling that a lot of the kind of institutions in the world are set up to suck our energy and steal our energy and so that's kind of the larger framework in which I see government institutions and rich foundations and these kinds of things. And I think, was it you who even wrote, I think it was you who wrote, like, voting is a way to, like, you know, agree to give your attention and psychic energy to government. Was that you or is that someone else?
I did write about that, I think, in similar terms anyway, around the whole Trump-Hillary thing, which managed to grab my attention against all my desire. And it's consenting, isn't it? I mean, even to take
consenting.
It seriously enough. To vote, and you're consenting to, and I see this throughout, you know, and TV shows and stuff that appear to be subversive because they're showing corruption, all the rest of it, but there's always this underlying message that the system basically works, we just need to work on it and tweak it,
right,
and fix it. And this is something I have never ever believed, you know, even as a child. Obviously I was born into a system that was highly dysfunctional, so how could I believe it? But I mean, I just had this inherent suspicion and maybe even hatred of, I guess you could even say the world, but I don't mean the natural world. But anyway,
yes,
what we're talking about, it's always been there. And then, you know, what led to the lucid view, to me writing it, was a period of about 7 years or something, between 20 and 27, when I discovered conspiracy theory in a nutshell, and UFO lore and all that stuff, because I wasn't really aware of it in my teens. But I stumbled upon it on Haight Ashbury with some Mae Brussel tapes and this, that, and the other. And you know, next thing you know, I was a duck in water. It's like, whoa, all this, I believed all of it in a way. I mean, not as in being completely gullible, but really I just thought, yeah, I always knew this. And so then I compiled it, you know, I just read all I could that followed my interest, and I it was going to be, I can't remember how many books now. What became The Lucid View was going to be the Bible of Hell, and it was going to, I think it was going to be a series of books anyway. Fortunately, I realized my hubris there, and I just sort of condensed it all down to this one book. Anyway, and the aim of the book was, to bring it back to what we're talking about, was to partly to show that if you dig deep enough, you find that the what we think of as conspiracies and high strangeness is actually in the cells of reality itself. Mm-hmm. At least what we think of as reality. You know, that, and it gets literalized into the Illuminati, all powerful, and the behind history, and in a sense, that's what I'm saying too, that we're talking about some forces that have actually shaped our culture and directed history from day one, but, really that force is the human unconscious that, you know, has been fragmented and polluted by,
right.
You know, by some, well, kind of unknown. I mean, that, at that point becomes unknown. And one of the things I want us to do with Lucifer, and I'm bringing it up because we wanted to talk about that so we can bring it back to that, like what your experience was to, and this is still my aim. So it is consistent. You know, Lucifer is consistent with what I'm doing now in that regard, was to show the negative aspect of existence so fully, and to show how one couldn't escape it, that it's absolutely in everything, in order to show that it's actually not negative. Like our perception is incomplete. Like if we can go all the way in, we will see that this actually is a journey to, you know, the center of what we are, into the abyss, I guess. In those poetic terms back then. Because this is us. This, all of this is us, is our unconscious that's acting out and creating a world in order to communicate with us. And therefore, this is the way through to wholeness, is to see the horror and the abomination.
Yes.
And in all its incomprehensibility.
Yes. Amen. Amen. Yes. Yes, that if we were to only bear witness to the horror that is our external reality, we could appreciate the horror that is also inside us and become whole, is what I think you're saying.
Yeah, because we can't, like, the horror that's inside us is, well, I guess I should ask you what you think about this, because on one hand it was put in us, so we need to get past it to what we are, but on the other hand, it's because it's become part of us, and that's what makes it so horrifying, is that until we actually recognize that it's us, we can't let go of it. We can't get to what we actually are.
Sure.
Beyond the horror.
Right. Yes. 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 It's the resistance to perceiving the horror that makes it persist.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, bring it to what you do, like the somatic saying. Like, what is it? How do you, what's your experience of this in terms of horror? Because we're talking about, and this is, we're talking about conceptual horror, really, as in seeing, oh my god, this happened and they did this, and oh my god, you know? It's still at a mind level, but the horror that I'm trying to communicate now is the secrets trapped in my body, and that's visceral. That's body horror.
Yes. Yes, this is exactly what I do on a body level. So any thought a client brings in, so clients come in, they say, blah, 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 my week this, my mother that, my husband this. And then I ask them, I support them in feeling the physical sensation correlating with whatever they said.
Right.
And then sitting with that sensation. Usually when you take your mind's eye and focus on a sensation, the sensation has a life of its own. And I just support them in focusing on the sensation as it does its thing. And part of the reason why I do that is exactly what we're talking about, to support them in bearing witness to self as self is in the sensational form and not just the intellectual form. And clients 9.9 times out of 10 have extreme resistance to bearing witness to their sensational self, because underneath sensation is a world of pain and memory and hurt and shadow that people are scared to witness. So a lot of the work I do is working with the protections to sensation. So I try to get them to sensation. 9.9 times out of 10, they resist perceiving sensation. And then I help them become aware of how they avoid sensation. And that's usually a historical, there's usually a historical experience where, well, every time I cried, when, you know, it usually gets into memory of every time I cried, my dad said, suck it up. And so getting into the memory and the emotion of the protection, helping that, then offering them a corrective experience where I will then speak to that part of them and offer them the missing experience, like and usually they're in like a child's mindset in those moments, and I'll say, I know that your dad said so and so, and I'm saying something else, and I really wish I could have been there to tell you that it's okay to cry. And usually people have a deep catharsis, but it's not about catharsis, it's about really just awareness that they have this protection. And once we move through that, then people, once we move through their protections and realizing the historical precedent for their protections, then people are able to start really doing the deeper work, which is going through the layers of their felt physical experience, and putting words to it in the same way you put your body into writing. I support my clients put their body into sharing. And it gets painful and it gets hard, and I kind of midwife them through it. Mm. How's that a quick summary?
Okay, the second part of this conversation will be up next Wednesday, the 12th of July 2017. You'll find that at horticulture.com/liminalist. I'd like to thank Matthew, Kevin, and Kelvin for donating and supporting this podcast between.